Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening from Fort Lauderdale. This is Stonewall Live, the best of gay and lesbian book, film, and media talk on Blog Talk Radio. Tonight I have author, poet, Trevor Healy with me. He's the author of the novel Through It Came Bright Colors, a selection of the Inside Out Book Club and the winner of both the Violet Quill Award and the Publishing Triangle's Farrell Grumley Award for fiction. His other books include the novel Fawn, which we'll be talking about in a few minutes, the short story collection A Perfect Scar, and the volume of poetry Sweet Son of Pan. A Horse Named Sorrow and Fawn are his two latest releases. Welcome, Trevor.
Hi, Nate. Great to be here.
Great to have you. First of all, I loved your books. They are beautiful prose. They couldn't be more different, but then after I thought about them, maybe they are alike. What started you writing?
Oh, you know, I think like anyone else, I was 12 or 13 and, you know, was having all these different feelings that I didn't know how to express, you know, being a gay kid and everything else. And I started writing poetry, you know, like a lot of people do at 13. But, you know, I didn't really start writing seriously until I was in my late 20s. I kind of came back to it and thought about it in a more serious way of, oh, I want to really write some stuff and write some books that are things that I would want to share with people.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, let's get right into it. Both of your books that I've read three of them, but I've read the two books we're going to talk about tonight, I would say that they struggle with religion pretty on a serious basis. Is that a personal struggle for you too?
I wouldn't say so much religion as, you know, spirituality, which kind of broadens that kind of theme, but you know, I was raised in a pretty strict Catholic household, so I think it was always very real to me. It was the world view that developed, you know, when I was a child was very much one that had a spiritual component. And then, you know, when I left the church, as I got into college, I wanted to explore other things, and I just happened to have the good fortune to meet some Buddhist monks and things like that, and I began to explore like that. I got very into the beatniks, and of course there's lots of Buddhist material there, and I was in San Francisco, which is of course kind of this spiritual clearinghouse. I was going to dead shows, and you could learn about, you know, tarot cards, I Ching. It was really a very rich kind of vein to explore, and you know, it's just, it kind of enlarges the world, so it's always been kind of an area of study and exploration for me.
Mm-hmm. And you get into Native American spirituality in A Horse Named Sorrow, obviously. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that is something that I got into. You know, part of this exploring in my 20s was I met some Native American medicine men who were doing sweat lodges, and I'd always been drawn to Native traditions. I thought they were kind of interesting, and I'd read some books and that kind of thing. But the sweat was really great because it sort of made it all real. And you're sitting on the ground. I was really into Buddhism at the time, and I was, you know, meditating and doing stuff and having a hard time. And when I got involved with the Native American tradition, I realized, okay, here's something that isn't so transcendent like my Christian upbringing, and even like Buddhism often is. Even though Buddhism is a lot better about being in the moment and dealing with what is, it still has a tendency of, you know, people are working towards being enlightened, or they're kind of, you know, thinking of what's kind of beyond their life. Whereas the Native tradition, sitting in that sweat lodge, you're sitting on the ground, you're sweating, you're just there, you're sitting around a fire. As one medicine man described to me, he said, you know, it's people sitting around a fire sharing their grief, their joy, all that kind of stuff, which is something that everybody can relate to. It's kind of the first thing that humans did. And it's very much that. So it has this very visceral feeling, and I love it. So I've continued to do that through my life.
And in Fawn, Fawn is a story about a young boy, 15-year-old boy, who wakes up one day and he's become starting to become a satyr. It's a fantasy novel set in contemporary L.A. And in that, I got an earthiness, kind of like a relationship, a human. This young man had been raised in a kind of a ghetto-type Mexican part of L.A., and all of a sudden he becomes a part of the earth. He starts to relate to the earth. So it's kind of the same thing. I guess that's your own journey in that.
Yeah, in some ways it is the same thing. I think that's kind of the way, you know, I mean, a lot of, I think, spirituality in this culture has been moving in that direction for quite a while, too. You know, this boy in East L.A., he's growing up in a very Catholic household as well. And, you know, it's very kind of removed from what a lot of people are experiencing on a day-to-day basis. But if you get into, you know, if you're just kind of dealing with the earth in front of you and even just, you know, having a more pagan relationship to things, mm-hmm. you know, it's something everybody can relate to because it's real to people.
Right.
And they can kind
right.
of pursue it in any way they want. But whereas, you know, a lot of these religions, especially as we become more educated and sophisticated, these religions with all their sort of ideas and books, it all becomes sort of like, well, whatever. It's just a mm-hmm. bunch of ideas. What's in front of me? What can I feel and taste?
Right.
And
right.
I wanted to do that with Fawn. I wanted to sort of create this being that is really, he's a real connection to the earth. I mean, fauns and satyrs are, you know, and pan are actual, you know, like earth spirits. And
mm-hmm.
so it's sort of, it's an exploration of that whole different way of exploring spirituality.
Yeah, and you do kind of connect spirituality and eroticism. How did that come about?
Yeah, I mean, again, you know, back to this earthy kind of thing. If you relate to your spirituality sort of through the earth instead of opposed to the earth, I mean, I think that's really the difference between, like, paganism and our more Judeo-Christian kind of, you know, religions that are removed and seeing nature as more, you know, the enemy or something to struggle against. It's, you know, with the fawn and any kind of, you know, pagan practice, it's really about embracing the earth and finding, you know, it doesn't mean you don't direct your energy the way you relate to it or express yourself in a constructive way with that energy. But it's this sort of acceptance, like in Buddhism, when you accept your body, this is the earth is what we are, and we are physical mm-hmm. beings in it, and our eroticism and our sexuality are expressed through that as well. So there's an embracing of it, a fuller embracing of the body.
Mm-hmm. Good. Well, you know, in Fawn, there is a lot of awakening of sexuality. You just mentioned awakening. And you
yeah.
do feel like Gil, the main character in Fawn, he becomes like sometimes a little bit scared when he's attracted to a man. He has a lot of little – there's this wonderful scene where he meets a transvestite. Talk about that.
mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, he ends up a runaway because he's growing. He's turning into what his mother perceives as like Satan or a demon inside the house, you know. So
right.
he's freaked out. He runs away. He's living on the street with some kids under Hollywood Boulevard, and he meets another fawn who tries to connect with some people who can help him. So he meets this transvestite who, you know, is kind of she's kind of like a herald. She sort of points, and this is where this becomes a very mythic story too. You know, she sort of sees, here's this kid on this journey.
Yes.
He's completely bowled over by it. He doesn't know what's going on. He doesn't even know what his own sexuality is. He's only 14 or 15. And she's sort of this wise person saying, well, you know, what she's really saying to him is, you've got to accept who you are, because he's resisting it. Is there some way I can, you know, have plastic surgery, have my horns filed
right.
off? What, you know, he's just
right.
panicked, right? And she's
right.
very much like, look at me. You're asking me. I'm a person who's about being myself and having the guts and really having the sort of courage to stand up and be yourself and encourage others to do so. And so she's sort of that voice, because he goes back and forth, and he doesn't necessarily listen to her at that point. But she's very important because she says that in a very direct way, in a sassy
right.
way that,
yeah.
you know, a 6'3" black transvestite would say to a young, you know, boy on the street.
Exactly. And, you know, I've always felt as a gay man, I've been lucky to be a, you know, a very tall, not imposing, but a gay man, a kind of, you know, not can pass for straight. But my coming out and being a gay man doesn't take as much guts as walking down the street in high heels and a bad wig. You know, I mean, which is what these people do, and they do it every day, and they put up this abuse, and they love who they are. They look at themselves in the mirror
yeah.
and they say, "Hi, this is who I am. This is who I can be." And this is what this is, of course, what she's telling Gil, is to first accept himself, and that's great.
Right. And this is why I kind of, with this book, you know, Gil isn't necessarily a gay kid. It's sort of unstated, but really, I'm sort of kind of broadening the idea of queer here. It's like, you know what? It's being yourself.
Right.
You know, because there are trans people who aren't necessarily gay. You know, I mean, our whole idea
right.
of like gay, straight, male, female, all that stuff. It's like, you know what, it's just all queer, and we need to just
right.
expand that as much as possible. So the story is really about when you feel like a monster, which is the one thing we
right.
all sort of have in common, when we don't feel we fit into these
mm-hmm.
roles that have been put in front of us. So it's really kind of about that as a larger theme.
Right, and in my journey of doing interviews for many years, both in person and over the radio, I have had, you know, many transgender people, and I've learned
mm-hmm.
about gender expression, gender identity, and gender orientation, and how it is, you know, that the line just keeps going in S-curves all over the
yeah.
place.
Yeah,
and that's good. And that's good how we see each other and how we express ourselves is a personal choice, and when we get free, it happens. All right, we're going to switch the subject to A Horse Named Sorrow. Wonderful book. As I was reading it, people are always asking me, they come up to me in the gym, in Starbucks, sometimes naked in the shower, and ask me, what am I reading? Because they know I'm a big reader.
Uh-huh.
and so I said I was reading A Horse Named Sorrow, and they said, what's it about? And I was very, very hesitant to call it an AIDS novel because so many of them fit into a stereotype of depression, almost a formula, and kind of like, you know, kind of a downer, though I do believe that there's a place for that. I told them it was a journey not unlike the Odyssey that was heartbreaking and life-affirming, and I can't believe where that even came from. It sounded like something out of a Lifetime movie. But that's how I felt about reading the book. I was actually, and I'm just, I'm going to give you a little plug here and get on Amazon.com, is that it was really sad to finish the book because I really was enjoying reading it. I loved it. So that's a big kudo to you. And the name of the book is A Horse Named Sorrow, and the other book is called Fawn, and they're available on Amazon.com. And you can read more about these books on TreborHealy.com, TreborHealy.com. There's our plug. Was that good?
Great. That was fantastic. Okay. And, you know, we can always add that this is a good thing for people to know about writers in general. If a writer has a website, always go to their website and go from their link back to Amazon, because when you link through a website, that writer gets a 3-4% return from Amazon. So I'm encouraging people, go to my website, look around, click on the book if you like it. When you buy it, I'll actually get a little something that way, because, you know, Amazon is making it really hard for writers because they require these huge discounts from publishers, which means everybody's take gets smaller and smaller, and the writers are, you know, getting down to nothing. So
yes, thank you very much.
That's the final part of the book.
That's the final part. And as I said, I used to have that link on my page, but My producer took that off. Thank you. I don't know why.
Yeah, no problem.
They took it off probably because of money. You know, the same reason.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. You finished both A Horse Named Sorrow. Let's go back to that. That is a lot of Native American culture. It's a journey not unlike the Odyssey. Our hero, Seamus, I love that name, is riding a bike called Chief Joseph. How did that come about? How did that name come about?
Yeah, so, you know, he meets Jimmy, who is his lover who dies in the story, when he had just arrived in San Francisco on his bike. And when he does die, he asks Seamus to take him back the way he came, which is sort of vague, and Seamus doesn't know what to do with it and is in his grief, is sort of confused anyway, and decides, well, he wants me to take him back on the bicycle. So he gets back on the bike and he follows the exact route back because Jimmy had left a map behind, and he takes Jimmy's ashes and he heads back on the road. So it becomes really a journey about, you know, how does, you know, Seamus is like a 22-year-old kid. How does he deal with his grief? And this was something that, you know, during this time period, 1990, 91, 92, there was tons of grief, you know, and I was always struck by these guys, you know, I knew who were like 21, 22 dealing with it, you know, and it was just so, it was like they weren't even adults yet, you know, they were just kids. And I always wanted to write this story for that reason. And I actually had ridden a bike across the country one summer long ago, so I was able to kind of build it around that. And you know, why the bicycle's named Chief Joseph, it's sort of a little bit of a mystery, but, you know, it's answered fairly quick in the book. And it's because Jimmy quotes Chief Joseph of, "I will fight no more forever." And that's really about how Jimmy came to San Francisco because he knew he was going to die. And, you know, like many people, they came to San Francisco, as was documented in that movie, We Were Here. A lot of people came to San Francisco from other parts of the country because we had a support system that had been created. There was this all these different groups that could support you. I mean, whether they were walking your dog or bringing you food, there were hospices, there was a great network. So many people came because they felt this was a better place to go through this. And then these two guys also get involved in ACT UP and Queer Nation, so they're able to, it's also a place to fight the epidemic. And there's all these people, you know. So it's, you know, it's about San Francisco being that as well. And then, you know, he goes back on the road, and that's when he really has to deal with the whole grief process.
Right. And I caught the parallel between the book, of course, that the map is in a book, which is A Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, which is about the injustice injustices that the United States did upon the Native Americans. And I saw the parallel, of course, it was easy, with what was happening with ACT UP and the injustices that the Reagan administration and later on other of the FDA did to the gay community, but the people affected with HIV. It was an incredible parallel, and it just kind of went, oh God, yeah, that right. Uh-huh, there it goes. So I think
it becomes a meditation somewhat on all the grief in this country. You know, this is such a cheerful country. You know, I was living in Argentina for the last year, and there's much more of a sense of, you know, they're dealing with, they had this dictatorship where lots of the children were disappeared. When I say children, like high school kids, college kids. And the grief is right in your face there. And here, there's a lot of grief here. I mean, you know, whether it's Vietnam or it's Seamus's father had been lost in Vietnam, the Native American genocide, all this stuff that's happened here. And a lot of times we just don't really look at it that much. On a day-to-day basis, it kind of is invisible.
Right.
And I felt like AIDS felt that way for a lot of us as well. It's like, oh, well, when we're all here at an ACT UP meeting or together with other gay folk, you know, it's like we're aware of it. But the minute we walk out of here and walk into some suburban mall or something, it doesn't even exist. And I think the sort of denial and the lack of processing, and I felt like in some ways – When someone deals with one grief, they're kind of engaging all the grief around them, and that is in some ways a Native American idea too, that like, you know, you're sort of this earth and of this place, and you're really of the grief that you feel is really the grief of the entire place. And when you think of all the things that have happened here, you know, in these places where Seamus is traveling, you know, which is mostly in the West here, it's like, you know, all this stuff and everything that these people have experienced, there's a grief that you've sort of accessed, and it's pretty huge.
Right, right, and what is your message in A Horse Named Sorrow? What's the writing theme and message of that? What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think it's as overwhelming as the grief is, and especially for this young guy who really has no tools or much support to deal with it, is like, you can get through this. And I think really it's about you keep moving, and you go with your gut. And if your gut says, get on a bicycle, you've never really ridden one before, you don't know where you're going, you've never left California, get on a bicycle and ride across, you know, Idaho and Wyoming, do it, you know?
That's just amazing.
Keep moving. And you can get through it, and I think ultimately it's redemptive that way. It's about keep moving through it. It's the only way, because people do get stuck in this stuff, you know, and their lives stop in a way, and they just kind of sit there and wait.
I've met many people. You are absolutely right.
Yeah.
And sometimes it doesn't
take... And we all struggle with this. Everybody can relate to it, you know.
Right. And sometimes it doesn't take a death of AIDS or turning into a satyr or you know.
Yeah, it can be losing a job. It can be you have a little bit of a drinking problem and you just decide not to deal with it and you're just going to kind of float along and see if you can manage it. I mean, you know, a lot of people manage their grief instead of moving through their grief to get out the other side, I think.
Correct. Or bad relationship. Gay men grow. So you finished both A Horse Named Sorrow and Fawn while living in Argentina. What was that like?
Yeah. It was fantastic. That? You know, I was kind of in a bit of a doldrum here in L.A. where I've been living. And, you know, I thought I got to do something. I just, you know, and I had a friend that passed away, a very close friend, Ernest Posey, who was a painter and a mentor to me. And it was, you know, I think I was, part of it was the grieving process of that. And I thought I got to go do something different. I think I was also feeling my own mortality. And I turned 50 this year. And I just thought, I'm just going to go do something I've always wanted to do. I always wanted to master a second language, and here I was fumbling along with my Spanish, and I thought, you know, I got to really get it. So I went down there and studied Spanish, and I always wanted to go to Argentina. And again, it's sort of like what I said about Seamus going on the road. I had no good reason. People say, why Argentina? I have no idea. I've always kind of been interested in it. I have no good reason, but that's where I'm going. And so I just kind of went. And I met great people down there. I fell in love with a guy. Everything was fantastic. I got my creativity back, basically, by, I think, going to a new place for me is always great. You get out there and do something different, shake it up. And these books I was able to finish down there. So it was great. I mean, I want to go back again. It's hard. It's far. It's just far enough away where it's a hassle, and it's not easy to, you know, I thought of relocating there for several years, but then these books are here, and I need to kind of get out there with these books.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote these in English, not in Spanish, so...
Okay, good.
Here I am.
It's interesting because I have a good friend who he is a web designer, and he lost his home in Katrina, and his home and his partner in Katrina, and decided to move to Argentina for many of the same reasons, only because he'd always wanted to go there. It was a cool idea, and he has been living there now since Katrina. And I just saw him a few days ago. He was here in town, but his energy and regeneration, and I just wondered, you're the second person I know that just picked up and went to Argentina.
You know,
and I went,
Yeah, the people there are just, they're so, it's basically an Italian country. It's something like 65% Italian ethnically.
Uh-huh.
You know, they had this huge influx in the early 1900s. And so, you know, it has that Italian feel of people are just kind of hugging you and they're very warm.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, it's really, like you immediately feel welcomed. It's a very warm country. It's, I just, it seems like kind of, you know, a little bit of an antidote to here because we're a little reserved and cold and busy. And, you know,
mm-hmm.
their economy is screwed up, so they're like, oh, well, you know, I mean, they have a very, they're kind of on the other side of, yeah, our economy already collapsed. So, you know, they're
right.
stressed, obviously, but they're not worried about what's going to happen next. They're kind of like, we've kind of been through it, and now we kind of need to,
right.
you know, fumble along. But really, you know, I think it gave everybody there, they have sort of a philosophical bent from that, not only the economic stuff, but what has happened there politically. I mean, the dictatorship there was a brutal, horrendous thing that, you know, changed that nation and, you know, and affected people. You know, talk about grief. You know, it's still going
mm-hmm.
on. You know, the kids are finding out who their real parents are now, who were adopted out to military families when their parents were
right.
murdered. I mean, there's just stuff going on there that's really
intense.
God. And poignant, lots of films and books coming out about it now, so that's interesting as well. But it's, even with all that darkness, they're like, they have this incredible ability to be happy and enjoy themselves, and they all kind of, you know, kind of to get along. I was kind of amazed with how they're all kind of getting along with each other and all that.
Really? Good.
I feel sometimes here where we have a hard time getting along with other people that we don't see are in our group or in our viewpoint,
uh-huh.
you know?
Right, right,
so.
Yeah. Somebody once said we were like 100 different nations here living all at once. So is
yeah,
our next book,
yeah.
our next book going to have an Argentinian flair?
Well, you know, I'm doing a prequel and a sequel to Fawn because I'm just sort of wrapped up in this character, Gilberto, now. But I am writing a novel about Argentina as well.
Oh, good.
So
good.
I'm not sure which one I'll get done first, so stay tuned.
Okay, we sure will. All right, I'm going to ask you one of my Nate questions. What writers
okay.
have influenced you?
Gosh, you know, Jack Kerouac was always a huge influence on me that I started reading when I was young, and that kind of comes out in my, you know, loving to write about the road. And
right.
I think, you know, really kind of writing from the heart, you know, not being sentimental, but writing from the heart, like, what do you really feel? What do you, and being instinctual, just kind of going with it and sort of liking
right.
characters who were kind of slightly lost souls who were setting out to try to figure out what the hell's going on.
Uh-huh.
You know, in terms of gay writers, Tom Spanbauer's had a huge influence on me. And if you know Man Who Fell in Love with the Moon, there's a lot of Native American material in that. And, you know, Tom grew up on a farm in Idaho right next to a Shoshone reservation. So he's very knowledgeable about that stuff. And I've spoken with him. And his books I recommend highly for that material, as well as just he's a great writer. I love his voice.
Mm-hmm.
So he's had a lot of influence on me. And, you know, otherwise I think – you know, Faulkner, Fitzgerald, those kind of classic writers that I really have always sort of felt like they taught me something that I, you know, try to emulate. I think we all sort of mimic what we read. So I'm careful to, I feel like I'm always trying to read good stuff so that if I start
mm-hmm.
mimicking anything, it'll be something good versus something else, right?
Oh, you know,
and right
Barbara
now I'm reading a lot of Latin American fiction. Yeah.
Okay, I was going to ask you, what are you reading now?
Yeah, so I've been reading lots of stuff from Argentina and Chile. I'm really into Roberto Bolaño, who's a Chilean but lived most of his life in Mexico and Spain, so he's really more of an international, you know, voice than he is just a Chilean. But he's very much a Latin American writer in terms
uh-huh.
of his, I think, his style and his kind of worldview. And then I discovered a great writer down there, Thomas Eloy Martinez, who's an Argentine writer. And these are all books you can get in translation, too. And I was reading some Maria Vargas Llosa from... I should say Llosa, but, you know, in Argentina they say Llosa, from Peru. And, of course, Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And the magical realism stuff is great, and that's been really helpful with the Fawn books because,
uh-huh.
you know, that's really kind of what Fawn is. I want it to be very real, but then, you know, he is a fawn, and he's this guy with horns and hooves, and so there is this sort of magical realism. And I don't want it to be a fantasy. I want the realism. I want a real story with a fawn in it. So magical realism
right.
has been really helpful to sort of show me
uh-huh.
ways people do that, you know.
Good. And are you reading these in English or in Spanish or in Portuguese?
Yeah,
or?
I'm reading them in English. In Spanish, I read like Sherlock Holmes. I read Oscar Wilde's children's stories. I'm kind of like a 12-year-old in Spanish, so
uh-huh.
I can enjoy young adult fiction. But when I read adult fiction, it's really kind of hard, so I notice myself putting it down and not doing it. So I'm focusing on reading the young adult stuff in Spanish. And I keep working on my Spanish, but I feel like I'm not quite ready to be reading, you know, Borges
okay.
in Spanish. It's hard to
well,
learn English.
I didn't know what your level was. Yeah. It's fascinating that a writer, you know, can switch languages. You know, because your craft is in English, and someday probably you may write in Spanish. But it's just so amazing that you just spent a year there. You mentioned Jack Kerouac, and of course, A Horse Named Sorrow and Fawn are about journeys. Both these young men go out on journeys, road trips and journeys. Not unlike Christ, Mohammed, Moses, Seamus, and Gil. You know, like good old Bobby. What do these two guys have in common, Seamus and Gil?
Well, I mean, I think they're both sort of they're people who they don't feel like they fit into their families, and they don't feel like they can really find a way. They can't find their place in the world. I think that's really what they have in common. You know, Seamus is a little bit older. He's 21, 22, and Huberto is 14, 15. So they're kind of in different aspects of that, not finding their way. And I think Huberto's going to find his way faster than Seamus does. But they both are kind of aimed that way, and I think you have the feeling that they're going to find their way. I mean, you know, Seamus kind of does, I don't want to give it away, but he kind of does find his way. It's a very strange way, but...
Right. Yeah, of course. We all. Well, did you expect anything different, you know, riding a bicycle across the country?
Yeah, no, Seamus was with me for many years. I took a long time to
read
this book, and I knew this is like a weird kid, and I don't know what the hell he's going to do. He's certainly not going to be selling, you know, life insurance. I mean, I don't know, where does this guy go, you know? And I thought of a lot of different ways that he could play out, but ultimately, I think I found the place that made sense.
Really good, because I think that book could go to a prequel and a sequel, too. I mean, I really feel like, you know, I want more, you know?
Yeah, but, that's the thing to hear, because, yeah, I don't feel it, but, it, you know, you never know. Yeah, it's, I mean, it always is curious. When you have young characters, especially, you think, well, you know, you could, you know, what happens to them in 20 years? I mean, you know, it is interesting, and it's something to consider, and I really feel strong about it with the Fawn. I feel like, oh, there's just way more stuff that I have to figure out about him. I'm not satisfied yet with where he's at and what he's
really
gonna do.
Okay. Well, he's pretty young. He is pretty young, and he just figured it out. It's not like a coming out story. There is a lot of wonderful little lines that I just laughed out loud in A Horse Named Sorrow. Of course, you know, my favorite is you know, the eating the pancakes and going back to the pancakes and the Holy Trinity and the pancakes. I just thought
that was right. He always gets those stacks of three. So Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost. Right. Yeah.
Oh my God, that was hilarious. You know, did you tell stories like that as a child to people?
I wouldn't say so much as a kid. You know, I'm one of four boys, and it was a pretty crazy competitive kind of, you know, fighting all the time, and it wasn't really storytelling. It was more like survival and trying to get as much food as you could, you know.
Okay.
But I think Seamus, in some ways, there's a part of me that, I mean, he's a very funny guy, and he sees stuff everywhere. He sees things in a very funny way, which is part of what I like about him, and part of what I felt was important, because, like, when you say, it's an AIDS novel or whatever, it deals with this heavy stuff, it's like, yeah, but it's also kind of this really funny, weird, quirky person dealing with sadness. And a lot of times the way people deal with sadness is by laughing and black humor and ways of seeing something funny, because you're desperately trying to find something lighter in all the heaviness. And that became a very enjoyable thing in writing the book with Seamus, because he was such a lovely person to go through this heavy material with, because he would come up with these crazy ideas, and I'd be like, wow, what's he saying now? I mean, I really did feel like he became this other person who talked to me.
Right, like you were channeling. We are down to the last minute. Do you believe this? How fast this 30 minutes has gone? I can't believe it.
Yeah, wow.
I know. So I'm going to ask you, what would you say if a young man stopped you on the street and said, hey, you're a writer. What should I do? I want to be a writer, too.
You know, what can you say other than, well, you got to just do it, you know? And I mean, I think, you know, depending on, how old they are, you know, you want to be encouraging, you know. I would say, hey, you want to write. Read good stuff. Be careful what you read. Read a lot. And then write. And when all these people try to discourage you, keep writing. But also ask yourself, is this really what I want to do? Because guess what? You're not going to make a living at it. It's going to be a struggle. A lot of writers go crazy and blow their brains or whatever. You might too. So be prepared for the minefield in front of you. If you're compelled to do it and you really want to do it, do it. You can do it. You know. And I would encourage you to do it. You know, be honest with yourself. Is what you want to do? Do it. Because there's a lot of reasons not to. And it does become sort of this this thing about, hey, is this how I express my soul? I mean, that's how I think I would answer that. It's like, I don't really have a choice. It's like an addiction, right? It's like, I have to do it. I got to get my heroin, you know?
Trevor, we are running out of time. I have to say goodnight.
Great.
Thank you so much,
Nate.
This was
fun.
We'll do it again sometime.
It was great.
Thank you.
Okay.
Good night.
All right, good night.